Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans. And this is so important to me. For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country.
Last night, I congratulated Donald Trump and offered to work with him on behalf of our country. I hope that he will be a successful president for all Americans. This is not the outcome we wanted or we worked so hard for, and I'm sorry that we did not win this election for the values we share and the vision we hold for our country.
President-elect Donald Trump's victory speech, Hillary Clinton's concession speech, and the Rolling Stones recorded off the loudspeakers at a Donald Trump rally in Rothschild this past April. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we look at one of the biggest upsets in American politics, the shocking Electoral College victory of Donald Trump, which came despite the fact that Hillary Clinton is now more than a million votes ahead of him, with still more to be counted in the Democratic Party strongholds of California and Washington State. It was a victory in which Wisconsin put Trump over the top as Secretary Clinton's upper Midwest firewall collapsed despite a Marquette poll showing her with a six-point lead going into the election. Our guests today are Donald Trump supporter Brian Westrate of Eau Claire, who is a Republican Party presidential elector for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, and Hillary Clinton supporter Christine Bremer-Moogley of Wausau, who is a former Democratic Party presidential elector for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Both also served as delegates to their party's presidential conventions in July. We're sure you've got a lot of questions and opinions today about the electoral process and the results of Tuesday's election, and you can share them with us at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742, or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it live on the air. Brian, let's start with you. Quite a surprise Tuesday night. Did you think it could happen, and how did you react when it did?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it could happen. Okay, I was telling people I put both the Trump-Clinton and Johnson-Feingold races at 50-50 going into this cycle. I had consistently told people I thought that there was a 4-6% unaccounted Trump vote, folks that simply were not on any pollster's radar, so therefore hadn't been polled. People who were not previously likely to vote, who hadn't voted previously, or perhaps Democrats who were going to vote down ticket for Democrats but vote for Mr. Trump for president. But again, 50-50. I mean, I went into it, you know, basically flip a coin, I thought. How I reacted? Ecstatically. I mean, to be honest, especially when Wisconsin fell. We were at our victory party here in Eau Claire for the county, and when he won Wisconsin, I mean, in addition to it being the first time since I was 6 years old, that was the point at which I said, there's no way he wins Wisconsin but loses the general. I mean, so in my mind, that was kind of the linchpin for the win. So, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I was a little more optimistic than the polls going into it, but certainly I you know, never would have bet any significant amount of money that he was going to win by the margin he did here in Wisconsin or by the electoral margin across the country.
Christine Bremer-Moogley, did you think it was possible for Hillary Clinton to lose given her lead in the polls, and how did you react when it happened?
You know, I'm still getting over you playing that Rolling Stones song, so give me a minute. you know, I think that when we hear that those lyrics, you know, Trump kind of took it over, and then when you say you can't always get what you want, but if you try, you can get what you need, I think the Democrats don't really believe that right now. You know, I think that I was sort of surprised that she won, that Hillary was able to win the vote, but that Donald Trump was able to win the Electoral College by the margin that he did. It was, for me personally, it was a very, you know, very hard night. I had served as the regional counsel for the Democratic Party in the North for that whole day, working on voter protection issues, and came home with a good friend. And we watched the election results, and we were both, you know, mortified, as I think most people were. As a woman and as a lifelong Democrat, it was something that I was hoping for more than anything, and obviously it didn't come to fruition. So was I totally surprised? No, I agree with Brian. I think I was almost to the same point. After the Comey announcement the week before, I was pretty convinced that there was going to be a difficult time for Hillary. So I wasn't a surprise, but it was certainly a horrible disappointment.
Hillary Clinton blames the letter from FBI Director James Comey for her defeat. Do you share that analysis?
Yes, I absolutely do. I think that the good friend of Donald Trump is Rudy Giuliani. He has, a great deal of connections with the FBI in New York, as we've learned. And I think that he definitely came forward at a time 11 days before the election where people were more or less with Hillary. She had a great momentum, and that momentum was taken from her. Almost similar to the collapse that Donald Trump saw with the Hollywood Access tapes. Of course, the conduct is nowhere near to comparable. But the collapse was comparable, and I think that Rudy Giuliani is asking for a favor from Donald Trump because he did a great favor for him.
Brian Westfred, yeah, let me have you respond to that.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that she's absolutely right that Donald Trump making some reprehensible comments on a bus 11 years ago is nowhere near the same thing as having a private server where top-secret information is stored that gives our enemies access to it as a result of failure to use the system. So I absolutely agree. I think that what Secretary Clinton did was significantly and demonstrably worse, especially given that she was running to be the leader of the free world. That being said, I don't think that I have never met a candidate who wants to own their loss. Okay, I mean, literally, all the way down to county board level. I mean, I've never met a candidate that goes, oh, you know what, you're right, I just failed to convince enough people to vote for me. I mean, it's part of the ego that goes into running for office, I think. And so it's an easy scapegoat to say that it was the Comey, the letter ahead of the election. We're going to ignore the fact that 8 days later or 6 days later or 4 days later, whatever it was, they came out and said, oh, we went through 650,000 emails. There was nothing in there. She's exonerated once again. Exonerated. Not, she's not exonerated. We still don't think any reasonable prosecutor would prosecute her. So, again, I think that what's happening here is the Democrats, the liberal left, is just they're failing to see why they lost. They're failing to see the 5-6% unrepresented in the polls percentage of Americans that I'm talking about, the flyover people. And what I've said consistently since the election is these are the people that they're like the Minnesotan DFLers, Democrat farmer laborers. They're Democrats or moderate Republicans who are just sick and tired of the establishment and Washington, D.C. not working for them, and then society or culture trying to tell them that the way they choose to live their lives is wrong. And they just revolted.
Quick response, Christine.
Well, I thanks, Brian. I understand that you have a position that's different than mine, and we're not going to agree on this. But I think what we can agree upon is that when the Hollywood Access tape came out, it wasn't just a simple little misconduct that Donald Trump alleged, admitted to. It was admitting to sexual assault. And so for women, that was
let her finish, and then you can speak.
I certainly didn't interrupt you. I think that it's important that you recognize that most women heard that as sexual assault, and under the law, that is sexual assault. And when you compare the conduct, a woman in her 60s misusing email and certainly with no intentional disregard for her duties as our Secretary of State and none found. And when FBI Director Comey came out on a Saturday afternoon and finally at the end of the week finally came out and said there was no prosecutorial offense here, I think it had a huge effect on the election. But I don't disagree with you that people generally don't admit to their failures in an election. And in this case, what we have is a situation where Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 1,340,000 votes, and the Electoral College, still by operation of that, Donald Trump won. This is a hard pill for any Democrat to swallow.
Brian, very quickly on the sexual assault charges, I want to move on. I don't want to relitigate the whole election here.
Certainly, that's a fair point. Just simply that I think that I mean, and as Christina said, and accurately, we have two different approaches to this. She views what Secretary Clinton did as a 60-year-old lady who just didn't know how to use email. Like, she's my mom, messages me, is this true, when she gets an email. No, this is the Secretary of State, a former First Lady, a former U.S. Senator, clearly a brilliant woman, using a private server for reasons, for her own reasons, and as a result of that, giving access to our enemies to top-secret information. And the FBI, quote, they were extremely careless with top-secret information.
Is there any Brian, is there any evidence that our enemies had access to that information from her server?
Yeah. The FBI has said that, that it, up to five foreign nationalities or foreign services gained access to those messages.
Well, now we know, if I could, Brian, I'd just like to respond with regard to foreign countries having access. We know that Donald Trump's campaign was in touch with the Russian government during the course of the campaign, and that is something that was reported by the Russian Assistant Secretary of State. So I think that the Russian government, actually, their Secretary of State indicated that the Russian government had been in touch with the Trump campaign. So when we talk about access to foreign countries, let's talk about what's really going on here. I agree with you. I don't think we should relitigate this, but we have to look at it with eyes wide open. There were many reasons that this campaign on the election went the way it did. One of them is the press, but I still believe that FBI Director Comey's conduct really had a big effect on this race.
Brian, as we speak, Mrs. Clinton is more than a million votes ahead of Mr. Trump. Does this raise legitimacy questions at all about his presidency? And how can he claim a mandate when a million more, maybe even 2 million more by the time they're done voting, more than 1 million people voted for Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump? How can he claim a mandate?
Yep. Briefly, let me just say that should be the first and last time anybody believes something the Russian government tells us. But I don't think – I mean, look, he'll claim a mandate because that's what politicians do. I mean, if they win, they claim a mandate. It could be one vote and they'll claim a mandate. I don't even know that he's going to do that. I mean, I think he just – this is a man who has been unconventional from the beginning, so I think he's just going to do what he's going to do. I don't think he's going to feel a need to claim a mandate. You know, look, the best example I've come up with is the World Series this year. Both the Indians and the Cubs had exactly the same number of runs over the course of the seven games. The Cubs won an extra game. They won the World Series. People who are messaging me asking me to change my electoral vote are asking me to change the outcome of a game, change the rules of the game after the game has been played. That's not the way it works. Our system is set up as a representative democracy, a constitutional republic. And what that means is you have 50 separate elections that take place on Election Day, and it's the person that wins the majority of those elections that wins the presidency. The reason for that is a pure democracy ends up ultimately in fascism. It's a bad idea. Throughout human history, it's a bad idea. So that's not what our framers set up. They set up a constitutional republic. And so Donald Trump has the overwhelming majority of America that voted for him. California, New York, Chicago, the population centers didn't. This is by design by our framers.
There are calls
all day long about the legitimacy of that design, but it has served our nation well for 240 years.
Brian, there are calls right now to do away with the Electoral College. And if you can just bear with me for a minute, let me go through one of the arguments. There are 38 million people living in California and about 500,000 in Wyoming. California has about 75 times as many people than Wyoming. Wyoming has 3 electoral votes. California has 55. But if you were to award those electoral votes proportionate to population – based on Wyoming's 3 votes, California should have 225 votes and not the 55 that it has. If you put it another way, if you're a rich white rancher who lives in Wyoming and you vote for president, your vote counts 4 times more than the vote of a poor black woman living in Los Angeles. We have minorities concentrated in the big states, as you said, and the small rural states are overwhelmingly white. So the argument goes that the Electoral College, which was written back in the foundation of the Republic to perpetuate the institution of slavery by giving disproportional representation to small rural slave states, and that today it's diluting the vote of minorities. And the argument is that it's a racist system. Is there something wrong with what I just said?
Yes, virtually everything about it. I mean, Did you just read off of what would like a Huffington Post or I mean
no
like, I mean
no I came up with that myself Brian.
The phrase,
Brian,
okay,
you don't know Glenn.
The poor white farmer in Wyoming, should they not matter?
No, they do matter. They do matter. The idea is that
they should all have their votes not count.
The argument
because they're poor white farmers in Wyoming. I mean, what does race have to do with it?
The argument is that one in a democracy we should have one person, one vote.
Except we're not a democracy; we're a constitutional republic.
How do you react to people saying that we should eliminate the Electoral College? Those are the arguments that I just gave you, and
I've already said because a pure democracy ultimately results in tyranny and fascism, and has through human history.
Well,
the system of government that we have set up by our framers 240 years ago is the worst system in all of human history, except for everything else. And it has worked very, very well for the last 240 years, has resulted in the world's largest economy, the most free nation, and the most military might that the world has ever seen that is used for good, where we do not build empires. When we win a war, we give land back to the people. So the Electoral College and the United States Constitution, as written, has worked very well both for the American people and the world as a whole.
Christine?
Well, you know, it's interesting. As an alumna of the Electoral College, 2008 and 2012, and I don't have a degree to prove it, but I do have my memories and my ballot. You know, I've done a lot of study on this, Brian, and I know you and I talked about that and how interesting it is when you're a member of the Electoral College about to convene 6 weeks post-election, how you receive letters from people all over the nation asking you to change your vote, usually from the opposite party that you are. When in 2008, I received many letters from people asking me not to vote for Barack Obama because they knew he was not an American and he was born in Kenya. You know, some of the letters that I'm sure you're getting are equally absurd. And so you have to, you know, look at what is the meaning of the Electoral College. And you have to keep in mind the Electoral College was part of the Great Compromise at the Constitutional Convention. And so, you know, what this was all about was to balance the interests of the large states and the small states. And so, you know, there are parts of me that agree that the Electoral College is a good system if electors actually have the independence to use their good judgment, if necessary, to vote for the right candidate. But that's not the way it is. The Electoral College now is made up of states who require political allegiance of every member, of every elector. And if you don't have political allegiance, you can be thrown off the college. And the Supreme Court has upheld that. So, you know, there are things about the Electoral College that I absolutely agree with you, Brian, that they are good. But there are things about it that could be made a lot better with regard to proportional representation, et cetera. So I think the Electoral College is something that we have to study. It's something that has excellent points, and I believe that the 12th Amendment to the Constitution is important. I think with regard to one vote for president and one vote for vice president, I think that Article 2 of the Constitution sets it up, and it is a good process. But I think that it is time to look at it, because when you have a vote like this one, the people lose confidence in their government, and we can't have that.
Brian, how many letters have you been getting asking you to change your vote?
It started as a trickle a couple of days ago, and I was reading every one of them, and at the time, early on, they were individual. I mean, people were sharing heartfelt stories, and some of them were absurd, but most of them weren't. I mean, most of them were well-written and well-thought-out. And then the spigot really got turned on, and they started to flow hard yesterday morning. Now I probably am getting about 100 an hour, and the vast majority of them are form letters. I mean, you can tell that there's some contact your elector.com or something where you put in your name, your city, and then press send. And so I was originally replying to them all with a message saying, hey, I heard you, thank you. I had some fabulous communication with people where folks were just happy to have been heard, but the sheer volume has made it so now I can't delete them fast enough.
Do we both agree that there's no chance the electors are going to change their vote between now and December 19th?
What I have consistently said is until I get 1.47 million Wisconsinites who send me a message asking me to change my mind, then no, I'm not going to.
But
I'm
representing
the vote in Wisconsin.
There is some discussion. They call an elector that doesn't follow the vote a faithless elector. And
right.
There is some discussion with regard to the faithless electors having the right, if there is a December surprise, that would say that this presidential candidate should not come into office. I doubt we'll have one, but you just never know, Brian.
Well, if it's discovered that he is, in fact, not a natural-born citizen of the United States or not actually 35 years old, or let's say it's proven that there was truly widespread actual ballot box stuffing or something. In my reading of Wisconsin law, like, it's unlike being a national delegate where you have an alternate and you
right.
sign a pledge. I mean, I didn't sign a pledge at any point, and there's no alternates that are going to show up with me when we vote on the 19th. State law suggests that there's a consequence on the back end, but I see nothing in law that gives that answers the scenario of what do you do if one of the electors at noon on the 19th doesn't do the will of the people. I can't see anything in law that says, well, then we get to take them out and put someone else in. I mean, there are no alternates. So as near as I can tell, you know, people could, in fact, be faithless. I mean, I have no intention of doing it.
Yeah, they
could. This whole
process
has been interesting.
They could, but there would be judicial review of their conduct, and if they had a good faith reason for changing, they might. But I just have to tease you, Brian, and say the reason you're getting so many letters is because it's not President Obama, it's President-elect Trump.
We have
it's a continuation of what has been, without question, a historically contentious presidential cycle.
We have a phone call that I want to get to. Jim in Merrill, you're on Route 51. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Glenn.
Jim, you're on the air.
This is Jim Moss. I'm the elector who wasn't invited to the party. I'm from the Libertarian Party of Wisconsin.
And your comment, besides what I think you're going to say, which is we're biased by just having the the electors that represent the two greatest vote totals in the past election?
Of course you're biased. my observation is that fewer people are voting in Wisconsin, and the membership in the red team and the blue team is down. The number of votes are down. The votes for both the new parties, the Greens and the Libertarians, is up. Together, they got 110,000 votes in Wisconsin. And I'm just wondering, is there any way that the red team and the blue team hope to attract those votes, or are they kind of depending on corporate support from the military-industrial complex and big pharma to overcome the new parties with lots of attack ads?
All right, Jim, we got it. Brian, you first, and then Christine.
God bless the libertarians. I do. I love them. I thought I was a libertarian in college. I still voted for Bob Dole in 1996 instead of Howard Phillips of the Constitutional Party, but... the Libertarian Party is not new. It's been around since 1971. Prior to this year, the best showing they had was 1% of the popular vote in a presidential election cycle. The Green Party is even worse. Has done even worse. And I think nationwide, like, the highest office they've had was, like, a county comptroller or something in the state of Washington. The Eau Claire County chairman of the party in 2008 coming in, I sat down with all of the disparate conservative groups, tried to work with them. The fact is they never come in to help. They never volunteer. They don't. We want them to vote with us, but they make the cost so incredibly high. The Libertarian Party seems to be willing to stand on the ash heap of our republic as long as they can point at everybody and tell us how right they were. God bless them. We agree 95% of the time. And if libertarians don't feel that makes us 95% friends, but instead 5% enemies, I guess I don't know what to tell them.
Christine?
Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin, Jim, by 27,000 votes, and Jill Stein took 30,000 votes in the election. Hillary Clinton would have won Wisconsin but for the loss to Jill Stein. But there's a reason the Dems lost to Jill Stein, and the Democratic Party has to look at that and realize that it's time to reform. And I hope that within that libertarian vote, there are many people that will come to the Democratic Party in the future.
Christine Bremer-Moogley, she's a former Democratic Party elector from the 7th Congressional District of Wisconsin. Brian Westrate of Eau Claire, who is a current Republican Party elector from the 3rd Congressional District of Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51. We'll be back after a short break. Here's Mose Allison, who passed away this week at the age of 89.
This world is just one big trouble spot, 'cause some have plenty and some have not. You know, I used to be troubled, but I finally saw the light. Now I don't worry about a thing, 'cause I know nothing's going to be all right.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Alumni Association, committed to preparing today's students to succeed in tomorrow's workforce through the University of Wisconsin's annual campaign. More at supportuw.org. Support also comes from attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
Neil Young being played on the loudspeakers at a Bernie Sanders rally last April at the Grand Theater in Wausau. I'm Glenn Mobrig. We're talking about the victory of Donald Trump and the future of the Republican and Democratic parties today on Route 51 with Trump supporter Brian Westrate of Eau Claire, who's a Republican Party presidential elector, and also Hillary Clinton supporter Christine Bremer-Moogley of Wausau, who is a former Democratic Party presidential elector for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Brian and Christine, this has been a very divisive election, and the divisions haven't completely healed. And what I think I want to do here is play a tape showing some of the different opinions that we've had. We're going to hear from Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, President Barack Obama, filmmaker Michael Moore, but first here's Omarosa, who is a Trump supporter.
Every critic, every detractor will have to bow down to President Trump. It's everyone who's ever doubted Donald, whoever disagreed, whoever challenged him. It is the ultimate revenge to become the most powerful man in the universe.
We elected a fascist yesterday, a 21st century fascist, someone who's a nationalist, someone who's a racist, someone who's a misogynist. And the thing is, he didn't get the most votes. Hillary Clinton got the most votes by 250,000. Yet he's the president. Is that a democracy?
Welcome to the dawn of a new, unified Republican government. Feels really good to say that, actually. This will be a government focused on turning President-elect Trump's victory into real progress for the American people. If we're going to put our country back on the right track, we have got to be bold and we have to go big. This country is expecting absolutely no less.
The presidency and the vice presidency is bigger than any of us. So I have instructed my team to follow the example that President Bush's team set 8 years ago and work as hard as we can to make sure that this is a successful transition for the president-elect, because we are now all rooting for his success in uniting and leading the country.
Well, President Obama is telling Americans that they have to accept Trump as their president. Many aren't listening. Thousands of people have taken to the streets to demonstrate against him, and the demonstrations are continuing more than a week after the election. Brian Westrate, your perspective on the fact that the divisions haven't healed yet, and specifically what you just heard with those four sound bites.
Well, certainly President Obama and Speaker Ryan are both reasonable men. Gifted leaders in their own right, obviously disagree on ideology, but you cannot question either man's, I think, integrity and leadership. The previous two messages were both, kind of beyond the pale to me, and which, God bless them. I mean, look, this is America. One of the things I continually tell people is that I think it is amazing. For 240 years, we have had the possibility of a fundamental transition, a 180 in power, every 2 years, because again, you've got the congressional races every 2 years, where this nation, the power, the control of the most powerful military in the world, in human history, can change hands every 2 years, and not a single drop of blood is shed. That is an amazing miracle of the Constitution. And so people let rhetoric get out of hand in today's information age and social media. People say things they would never say to each other face-to-face. They would never say to a candidate if they're standing in front of them. But that's still okay, because the alternative throughout human history is power has only been transferred at the end of a sword covered with blood. So, you know, I think people have a right to protest, to let their voice be heard. They can continue to do that. The media will cover them. America will be fine. Donald Trump was my last choice in the primary, and I became a Trump supporter once it was either him or Hillary. I am at least willing to wait until January 20th. I mean, maybe let's give him a couple days, like January 30th, maybe, and before we declare he's going to be a terrible failure as a president.
Christine?
Well, you know, I think that's very interesting that you'd say you want to give him some time. And I felt that way also until I heard who some of the potential picks for Secretary of State were. And that kind of really worried me, Brian, when we hear some names like Gaffney and Rudy Giuliani for these positions. And so it worries me a great deal. But I think you're right, and I agree with you 100%. I think that people voicing their opposition to this now and getting out and really having a position is very important. You know, Bernie Sanders said yesterday, you know, we're not going to go silently into the night. The Democrats are going to reorganize. We're going to educate. We're going to make certain that the people know, you know, what is really at stake for them. And then we're going to act. You know, there are some things that Donald Trump has promised that are certainly against what the Freedom Caucus of the House Republicans believe. And when Paul Ryan says we have a unified Republican government, and that's the message to the country, when the majority of the folks voted for Hillary Clinton, I think it's a very troubling message. And so I think it would be nice if we could, for a moment, as President Obama asked, to be unified. But it doesn't seem like that's going to be possible right now.
We're going to move on to some of the things Donald Trump says he wants to do during his first 100 days. He now says that he will start deporting 2 to 3 million immigrants immediately upon taking office, and he still wants to build the wall. Some Republicans in Congress are talking about actually approving funding for that before he takes office. Let's start with you this time, Christine, and then go to Brian.
You know, what we can do when we hear about these deportation squads that people are hearing about, and people are legitimately terrified about what could happen to them. You know, that's really something that we as a nation have to look at and say, are we going to stand up for it? Are we going to just be quiet and not do something to fight against that? And I think from people on my side of things, many of us believe that we have to stand up, we have to protect, and we're not going to allow that to happen without due process. And so, you know, my stepdaughter goes to the University of Montana at Missoula, and the students there are organizing now to make the commons there a zone where people will be protected from deportation. I mean, the students, the young people are going to organize. They are going to become educated, and they are going to rise up. You know, we had our awakening, Glenn, you and I did, in the Vietnam War, and that was our political awakening. And I think this is going to be an opportunity for political awakening among many young people.
I would also mention, Christine, that I grew up in a conservative Republican household.
All right. Well, that's that's amazing. I certainly didn't. I was raised in a Democratic household in the city of Chicago, so when you start talking about the Cubs, Brian, you got to be a little careful around us, Brian, Glenn and I. But, you know, the fact is that, you know, these kids are going to – these millennials, the majority of whom voted for Hillary Clinton, are going to have their political awakening now. And I think that's great. It's horrible to think that people are not thinking about politics. They have to think about it now. And we're going to come together, and it will take time. You got to remember, the Democrats that are listening to this, in 2008, the Republicans were in the same position that we are now. And look how it flipped. So, you know, the country is on a razor's edge. And and anything can turn it. And we have to make certain that we're listening to the people and not miss our opportunities.
Let's move to foreign policy. President-elect Trump wants to rebuild the military and take aggressive action to defeat ISIS. Brian Westrate, the fact that ISIS became a threat during the last years of the Obama administration, how crucial do you think that was to Trump's victory?
I think it was part of it. I mean, I think it was one of a 10-point part. But I mean, you didn't give me a chance to address the last question, which I'd just like to at least point out that he's not talking about rounding up 2 to 3 million immigrants, like my sister-in-law, who is a legal immigrant from Russia, or her mother, who is also a legal immigrant from Russia. He's talking about rounding up illegal immigrants, and specifically those who have committed a crime in the United States. That's a different animal. I mean, I'll say again, the problem that most conservatives have with illegal immigration is not the immigration part of the phrase, it's the illegal part. And so, I am a child of immigrants as well. The nation is a nation of immigrants. We love immigration. It's the illegal part we have a problem with.
So we're also a nation.
It's the selective application of the law that we expect President Trump will undo. Regarding ISIS, obviously, yes, it's a big part of it. National security is a big part of it. You know, on 9/11, we saw 19, Islamic fascists bring down the Twin Towers, crash in Shanksville, crash into the Pentagon. Since then, we've seen Nice, we've seen a bus driven through a crowd of revelers in Nice. We've seen the Orlando shooting. We've seen Fort Hood. On and on and on. And so there is a legitimate concern about the ongoing war on terrorism and the times when terrorists get to our nation's soil supported by ISIS and other Islamic nation states. Yes, that was definitely a part of it in this cycle.
Now, this is for both of you. Given the fact that Mr. Trump is now commander-in-chief, or will be soon, he has said some pretty inflammatory things on the campaign trail. And there's one item. I'm not going to play a lot of his comments from the campaign because I understand there's such a thing as a campaign, and then you have to govern. But this is a story that he told while campaigning about General John Pershing, who was involved in military actions in the Philippines. The story is not true. Pershing never did the thing that Trump describes, but nonetheless, he said it on the campaign trail.
And General Pershing was a rough guy, and he sits on his horse, and he's very astute, like a ramrod, right? And the year was early 1900s, and this was a terrible problem. They were having terrorism problems just like we do. And he caught 50 terrorists who did tremendous damage and killed many people. And he took the 50 terrorists, and he took 50 men, and he dipped 50 bullets in pig's blood. You heard that, right? He took 50 bullets, and he dipped them in pig's blood. And he had his men load his rifles, and he lined up the 50 people, and they shot 49 of those people. And the 50th person, he said, "You go back to your people, and you tell them what happened." And for 25 years, there wasn't a problem, okay? 25 years, there wasn't a problem. So we better start getting tough, and we better start getting vigilant, and we better start using our heads, or we're not going to have a country, folks. We're not going to have a country.
Brian Westrate, as Commander-in-Chief, do comments like that pose any problems with his efforts to get our Muslim allies overseas to help us in the war on terror? And to help us with people who are Muslim who live in this country, who we're depending on to let us know what's going on in their community.
Well, if he makes those comments as Commander-in-Chief, absolutely, there is a problem. I don't know when he made those. It's the first time I heard it. I don't know, and I'm not going to defend that statement. It sounds like he got an email from somebody and failed to use Google, which is what I do when I get emails that seem too fanciful. I try not to share erroneous information. But again, I think the key that you need to acknowledge there is he's talking about terrorists. Okay, we here in Eau Claire, we have a bar owner whose uncle was killed in the World Trade Center. And part of his bar, he had, like, Tuesday night was something like kill a terrorist night, rail drinks are $2 or something like that. And he caught holy heck from the Democrats on our campus, the college Democrats, saying that he was being anti-Muslim. And he pointed out rightly that the promotion is kill a terrorist, not kill a Muslim. They're the ones that added the word Muslim to terrorist. Okay, and so what President Trump, then candidate Trump, was talking about was killing of terrorists. That's, I mean, anybody who doesn't think terrorists should be dealt with swiftly, and I'm not going to argue killing, because I'm not going to argue for killing anybody. We should try and not kill anybody. But dealing swiftly and effectively with terrorists, those who would want to do significant harm to America or to Americans, I think is something we can all agree is a function of the federal government.
And Christine, that comment, lining 50 terrorists up and dipping bullets in pig's blood, shooting 49 of them, how do you think our Muslim allies are going to react to that? How are Muslims in America going to react to that?
Well, I think any straight-thinking human would agree that what he's talking about is committing a war crime. And when governments commit war crimes, they open up their citizens to have the same put upon them. It was extremely irresponsible of him as a candidate and the nominee of the Republican Party during the convention, after the convention, to say such a thing. And it's outrageous. So, you know, we are a nation of laws, and we are a world of laws with regard to our world courts at The Hague. We do not agree to this kind of conduct, and he should not be espousing it in any form, even in the heat of an election. No one is in favor of terrorism, but we also believe in due process of law.
Let's look at some of Donald Trump's other campaign promises and what he wants to do in the first 100 days of office. He wants to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Brian, what is he going to do with the 20 million people who lose their insurance when that happens?
I don't know. I mean, I watched him on his 60 Minutes interview where he said that the plan, the replace plan, would account for those people. For what it's worth, I don't think it is 20 million at this point. But the other issue is, I think that was even a bigger issue than ISIS in this election cycle, because you have at least that many people who have lost their insurance as a result of the ACA, or lost their job, or had their hours cut, or had the business they worked for go out of business, or the business they owned. I myself, within months of the ACA going into effect, got a letter from my insurance company that said, sorry, we're not going to offer health insurance in the state of Wisconsin anymore. So not only did I not get to keep my insurance and my doctor, like President Obama promised me, but I had to pay higher rates for less coverage. And so that's what has happened to tens of millions of Americans across this country as a result of the ACA. And so that brings us back to the promises. I mean, I don't know why all of a sudden the left is bound and determined that everything Donald Trump has said in the last 10 months is going to happen when he becomes president. I mean, Barack Obama told us that Gitmo was going to close. 8 years later, it's still open. He promised we'd be able to keep our doctor, we'd be able to keep our insurance. Those things didn't happen. I mean, politicians make promises and then they have to govern, and they find out that it's just not quite that simple. You don't get a magic wand when you take office. So, I think that it would be really, really hard to do worse than the ACA. So I look forward to hearing what the replacement plan is that comes out of a combined Trump-Republican Congress.
Christine?
Well, it seems like in the first quarter of open enrollment this fall, Obamacare has increased and over a million people have attempted to enroll. So it isn't the disaster that some people like to portray it to be. I think that there are at least maybe 20 million is an exaggeration. I agree with you, Brian. But I think it's at least 11 to 15 million people that will be thrown off the rolls. And as a personal injury lawyer and someone that deals with people who have health care needs very gravely after injury, I understand the needs of the people in central Wisconsin for health care. And I know how important it is for them to be covered for pre-existing conditions and for them to have coverage for their 26-year-old children and also to have coverage that is not capped when they have catastrophic injury or needs. So I think it's really, really important that when we talk about what the ACA or Obamacare has meant to this country, it's meant a lot to a great many people, and it has been a success in that regard.
Let's see if we can get Christine to agree on something that Donald Trump wants to do. $1 trillion in new infrastructure spending over 10 years.
Love it. I think that would be a robust program for infrastructure spending would be very important, especially to the people in the north where I live in Wausau and I spend a lot of time up in Lac de Flambeau, and I can tell you the roads are crumbling. We have no broadband. You know, you worry about driving over bridges. If he can get this in favor, if this can go forward, this would be fantastic, and I would sing his praises.
Brian Westrate, real quick. We're running way behind time here.
Sure. Look, we're $20 trillion in debt as a nation. That's over $212,000 per federal taxpaying unit or household. If he wants to spend a trillion extra dollars, he's going to have to bring in well over $1 trillion in additional revenue, not through increased taxes, but through more taxes being paid as a result of a booming economy. I guess if that happens, then winner, winner, chicken dinner, everybody's better off. But we should not be spending more money without the money to pay for it.
We're going to take a quick break. We've got Republican presidential elector Brian Westrate of Eau Claire and former Democratic Party presidential elector Christine Bremer Moogley of Wausau. Here's Ray Charles.
I'm talking about America, sweet America. You know, God done shed his grace on thee. Yes, he did, in a brotherhood, from sea to shining sea.
Support for WPR comes from the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin Foster Care Program, dedicated to helping thousands of Wisconsin foster kids connect with caring families. More about being a foster parent is at chw.org/TFC.
Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for a man.
Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel taking us into our final segment on Route 51. I'm Glenn Moberg, and our guest today, Brian Westrate of Eau Claire, a Trump supporter, and Christine Bremer Moogley of Wausau, who is a Hillary Clinton supporter. Let's go to the phones. We've got time to squeeze one more phone call in. David in Wausau, you're on Route 51.
Hi, Glenn.
Yes, you're on the
All
air.
All right. Yeah, my question actually is for Christine Bremer Moogley, and will this outcome of this election affect how the DNC looks at its candidates in the primaries and in regards to suit delegates and superdelegates and who they back?
Well, Christine, you're a superdelegate. You were a Clinton supporter, and I think David is getting to the point that some people think Bernie Sanders was treated unfairly.
Correct.
Right, and I hear you, David, and I was a superdelegate, and you know, it was a very tough time for all of us that were superdelegates because, of course, we loved what Bernie Sanders had to say. It was a question of whether we as superdelegates, just as an elector, using your own independent judgment and based upon your knowledge of the issues, decided who would be the best one to run as our nominee. And so people made that decision. I made the decision for Hillary Clinton well before Bernie Sanders ever announced, and because I knew her work and I committed to her then. But I think you raise a good point with regard to reform of the DNC, and I am no longer a member. I resigned in June, and Senator Janet Buley took my place. But you know, I believe that it's really important that the DNC take a deep look as to where we were and what we can do to change, because we should never ever lose members to feeling that they are not being fairly treated. And I think Bernie Sanders supporters felt that very strongly, and we can never let that happen again.
Christine, how does this personally affect you, the loss of the first woman to run on a major party ticket for president? She lost despite getting more votes than her opponent.
Well, for me personally, it's been very, very difficult. I try to As an optimistic person by nature, I look forward and I think, okay, what is the good that we can come out of this? And I've looked to the millennial awakening. For me personally, as a woman, it's very difficult. I watched Hillary Clinton last night when she gave her speech to the Children's Defense Fund, and I was so heartened when she said, we have work to do for the sake of our children and our families and our country, and she urged us to stay engaged on every level. And she was speaking to me when she said, America needs you, your energy, your ambition, your talent. And so, you know, we all get emotional about this, and I think that it's important we stay engaged, and I intend to.
Brian, you're going to have the last couple of words here. You mentioned that Donald Trump wasn't your first choice. Do Republicans have to work to keep his worst instincts in check in order to make him a success?
Probably, but that's the nature of the checks and balances of the system that we have. And on a positive note, the Republicans are controlling both the House and the Senate, and so they are in an excellent position to do so. I would like to just say that to the previous caller that one of the things I found interesting is with the 17% superdelegate, the Democrats were significantly less Democratic than the Republicans are. And regarding women, I think that Christine's right. My daughter, who is 9 years old, and as you may imagine, knows what's going on. We listen to the news together on the way to school every morning. That, she said one day, the silver lining, Dad, is that if Hillary wins, she'll be the first female president. Now, conservatives and myself included, we don't think that subjective aspects of birth are why we should choose our leaders, but it is ignorant to not acknowledge that it matters to communities of color or race or sex, that having the first female president will matter to women, and it should men.
Brian,
Hillary Clinton just wasn't the right choice.
Brian, thank you so much, and I wish we had more time. We could go on for another hour, but unfortunately we can't. Brian, thanks, and Christine, thanks so much for being with us
today. Thanks, Glenn. Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Christine.
Give us your tired and weak, and we will make them strong. Bring us your far-run songs, and we will sing along. Leave us your broken dreams. We'll give them time to mend. There's still a lot of love living in the promised land. Living in the promised land.
And we want to thank Brian Westreit of Eau Claire and Christine Bremer-Moogley of Wausau. Thanks also to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Janice Schleiss, production assistant, Eli Frieders. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by the Rolling Stones, recorded at a Donald Trump rally in Rothschild. Neil Young, recorded at a Bernie Sanders rally in Wausau. Sean Hopper, Mose Allison, Ray Charles, Simon and Garfunkel, and Willie Nelson. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.